This week, our castaway is the actor, humorist, artist, cartoonist, and broadcaster, William Rushton. William, what are your feelings about a desert island? I mean, it suits some people better than others. How could you envisage the idea?
I'm frankly terrified. I mean, the thing that really worries me is how I got there. I don't take ships, so it has to be a plane crash. So I see myself now having done a Robinson Crusoe alone on this beach with 600 plastic lunches, which are going to slowly decay as I sit and watch them. The other thing, of course, you never tell us is what size this thing is. It is quite a reasonable but deserted island, but is there vegetation, rock faces, perhaps?
Oh, yes, rock faces, vegetation. You can pick your own island, providing it's not too big. How about music? Does that mean a lot to you?
It's a strange thing in my life, music. I am... no real musical taste whatsoever. I think basically I like listening to the radio and being surprised. I mean, what I enjoy most, I think, is driving down the motorway and just fiddling with this. I have this one little button you can press at the least dangerous moments when there aren't juggernauts racing on either side of you, and see what comes up. And then I'm quite happy with it. It can be a bit of Mozart, or it can be a showstopper, or some meaningless pop number.
Have you any executant skill? Do you play an instrument? Do you sing?
I think, almost better than anybody else on earth, but there are disagreements with this. But I have rather good bathroom baritone and an amazing repertoire.
Did it take you a long time to choose just the 8 discs that you were going to take for this indeterminate period?
I was a bit worried about what 8 it would be. It was clearly a moment of panic. Apart from getting the 600 lunches out, I would be seizing records in the plane. So what I did was I wandered around for about a day, and anything that I started humming was obviously something or sang in the bath, I wrote down immediately. So this is a purely gratuitous 8.
Right. What's the first one?
The first one is from Gypsy. It's the overture. And it's a wonderful showbiz noise. I think it would sort of remind me that many years ago, before I got wrecked on this lone strand, that I actually was in the theatre. And I think if I'd been sitting in the dressing room before I heard this over the intercom, I would be immediately lifted. I would know that when I went out, it was going to be terrific. I've had to be Ethel Merman, admittedly, which I'm not. I never have been, although our voices have been compared over the years. But I think this is the rousing, grand showbiz number, the overture to Gypsy.
The opening of the overture to Gypsy from the soundtrack of the film. William, where were you born?
Chelsea.
In London?
Privately. Yes. In fact, the family had my mother and father, I was an only. They lived in an upper maisonette in Philbeach Gardens, which is off the Warwick Road, and there was court and a cage erected out of the back in which the child Rushton was sunned and aired. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it had to be moved, but they started building the Earl's Court Pavilion, and the brick dust began to settle on my infant face.
You were, in fact, born with ink in your veins. Your father was in the publishing business.
He was a publisher, yes. He worked for any number of publishers, I think. He ended up with Caxton, I think it was, who did the dictionary's resume, but he'd been through Chatto and Windus and Sampson Low.
Then you were educated at Shrewsbury, where you edited the school magazine. Was this the official magazine, or some jelly press job that was private enterprise?
No, this was before we got at it. It was a very proper magazine, purely sort of sports reports and reports of the debating society and the literary societies and visits by field marshals and that sort of thing. And Richard Ingram and I and Christopher Booker and Paul Foote, who ultimately moved into private eye, had about sort of 2 years at it and did change it to some degree. It became a rather livelier publication. Much of the blame for Private Eye can be laid on Shrewsbury.
Were you drawing at that time?
Yes, I've always drawn more than I've written.
So you put your own drawings in the magazine?
Oh, absolutely. No point in being editor if you don't.
Yes.
I wasn't very good. I mean, I wasn't bad, but I definitely committed myself then to black and white and caricature, and I still call myself a cartoonist to this day, never an artist. I'm a cartoonist, and it's a proud label to wear.
So one way and another, that was a pretty distinguished school magazine, different to most school magazines.
Very, I think. We still had the Debating Society reports and sports, but the prose and verse columns were longer and
yes,
generally perkier.
And you used to illustrate the headmaster's speeches occasionally.
To some extent. He never liked us.
Let's have your second record.
The second record, well, this is having been born in London and raised in it and lived in it most of my life. The one that would, I think that there's a moment of mawkishness required on my desert island. I won't listen to these records all the time. Very rarely, probably, but there may come a moment when I would like a bit of deep nostalgia. So I think Noel Coward singing London Pride, which he composed, I believe, on Victoria Station while the bombs are raining down. For some strange reason, he was humming Deutschland, Deutschland, überall, which is very similar, but it's a delightful song, and it'll bring back the Blitz to me.
London Pride has been handed down to us. London Pride is a flower that's free. London Pride means our own dear town to us, and our pride it forever will be. Hey, ladies, when the day is dawning, see the policeman yawning on his lonely beat. Gay lady, Mayfair in the morning, hear your footsteps echo in the empty street. Early rain and the pavement's glistening, all Park Lane in a shimmering gown. Nothing ever could break or harm the charm of London town. In our city darkened now, street and square and crescent, we can feel our living past in our shadowed present. Ghosts beside our starlit Thames, who lived and loved and died, keep throughout the ages London pride. London pride has been handed down to us. London pride is a flower that's free. London pride means our own dear town to us, and our pride it forever will be. Grey city, stubbornly implanted, taken so for granted for a thousand years. Say, city, smokily enchanted, cradle of our memories, our hopes and fears. Every blitz your resistance toughening, from the wrist to the anchor and crown, nothing ever could override the pride of London town.
Noel Coward bringing back the Blitz to you. After Shrewsbury, did you go to university?
No. I would have liked to, but you required mathematics, and I took that level maths, I think, seven times. And I'm mathematically dyslexic, without no doubt about it. In my last term, they said, if you take biology, they said, this will count. So I did a quick crash course in biology. I went into the examination, and there was a terrible thing in a bottle. And the first question was, what is this? And I put, vile. And at that moment, my university career ended.
So you left school under something of a cloud to do what?
Well, first of all, I had to go in the army. Everybody did. I mean, you wouldn't get everybody to go in the army now, but I think we were sort of born with a very sense of duty, and most of our fathers had been in, and somehow you just did it.
What did they give you to do in the army?
It was very strange. I thought the Education Corps would be quite useful because you became a sergeant almost once, or the Service Corps and learned to type. So I put REC, RESC, and I threw in RAF as a possible. And I got this letter one morning, report, 15th November 1956, I think it was, report the 5th Royal Enniskilling Dragoon Guards in Catterick. I thought, Irish cavalry! Oh, Lord, I've been in charge of stuffing horses into tanks. I mean, that's pretty dreadful. What have I got to do with this? And it was good fun, actually. I think I was in about 11 different regiments and units before I finally got out.
Now, had you any clear idea while you were sitting there in barrack huts what you were going to do when they took your uniform away?
Absolutely none, I will admit. And I still don't know what I'm going to be when I grow up, I don't think. I didn't know what to do. I thought advertising might be it when I came out. I thought I can do half the time's crossword, I can do jokes, I know, and I can draw a bit. So I sort of volunteered my services all around. What I really wanted to know when I went to see these personnel men at these huge advertising companies was what you had to actually do to be an advertising man, which they all ignored totally. They refused to answer this question. And finally, an old friend of my father's dead and he died about my last year of national service, and an old friend of his, who was a solicitor, said, you need a qualification. I don't really need a qualification, but at the same time, I saw this 7 years in which I didn't have to make up my mind what I wanted to do, and I ended up with a qualification.
So I went and became an article clerk to him.
Did that interest you?
Not a lot, but what it did give me, I think, which was quite useful, and everybody should do it, is some idea of how offices work. Mm. That actually you can get away with murder. And I discovered being a solicitor really was just keeping up a bold front while people spoke to you about their wills or their conveyancing. And the moment they'd left the office, you rang for your managing clerk or you looked in a book on the shelf and you then sorted out what you had to do. Yeah. And I think I could actually be quite a good solicitor now.
How long did you stay there?
A year. Then exams loomed, and I thought, no, I can't go through all that again. I will not do that. And I took a fairly bold decision to become a freelance cartoonist. Mm-hmm. And the first job I got was Michael Foote. Pulford got it for me, I think. He was an editing tribune. They were looking for a political cartoonist. And I did a couple for him, I think. But then Michael Foote said he was a great admirer of Vicky, and I had this... I couldn't actually write depression on clouds, and I hated putting the name of people on their coats or their briefcases.
Mm.
And he was very into that. He liked that, the old Vicky star of knowing what everybody was and having bulls running at red rags saying parliamentary left or, you know, complicated. And I couldn't do that. So I left Tribune, voted Conservative. I think I was thrown out on the Tuesday, voted Tory on the Thursday, and then went and joined the Liberal News, who were looking for a cartoonist.
At this point, before we get a little dizzy, let's break through the third record.
My great love in life has always been Broadway musicals, I will admit. I will go and see anything that comes out of the American musical stage. And one of the great ones, I think, was The Music Man. And the song that very rarely heard from it, which is wonderful in the bath, and I can sing it vaguely, but I think I have a lot of trouble with the band, is Marion, Madam Librarian, sung by Robert Preston.
What can I do, my dear, to make it clear? I need you badly, badly, Madam Librarian, Marion. If I stumble and I busted my whatchamacallit, I could lie on your floor unnoticed till my body had turned to Cambrian. Madam Librarian. Now in the moonlight, a man could sing it. In the moonlight, and a fellow would know that his darling had heard every word of his song with the moonlight helping along. But when I try in here to tell you, dear, I love you madly, madly, Madam Librarian, Marion, it's a long lost cause I can never win, for the civilized world accepts as unforgivable sin any talking out loud with any librarian such as Marion. Madam Librarian.
Marion the Librarian from The Music Man, sung by Robert Preston. Right, William, you've been in three political journals of three political parties. What happened next?
I got some children's books out of the Tribune because one of my cartoons had this bull charging at the red rag, which is Tribune. I got some animal stories to illustrate for Harrop. And I wanted to keep on with that very much, the illustration side, but I was also having a very good extramural university education in that I was going up at weekends, which are quite the best times to go to universities. You don't have to worry about the weekdays. I mean, they're class lectures and the rest of it, but I used to get enjoying all the social stuff.
Which university?
Both of them I used to go to, which is what confuses people.
Well, Oxford and Cambridge?
Yeah, Oxford and Cambridge.
Alternate weekends?
Yes. Yes. So people ask me which one I was at. I'll be at whichever one you like. Yes. Yeah. And when they ask me what I got, I always say first in grades because it pleases them to think that I did. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've said to people I didn't go to university, they say, oh, yes, you did. So I fight them off. You know, I've given up fighting. I now say,
Which courses do they have on Sundays?
Well, it was basically expensive drinking. I can remember doing a survey of the pubs of Oxford for ISIS. That was a very interesting weekend. I think we covered some 70 pubs in a weekend. Oh, a lot of drawings I did for Mesopotamia, which is a magazine that we started up there, which was run by a man called Peter Osborne, who later started Private Eye. So that was cooking. Richard Ingram and Paul Foote were up there doing another magazine, which was constantly being sued, called Parson's Pleasure. I did a lot of pictures for that. And I also did an Oxford review, a late-night review, in a defrocked church in Edinburgh, at the Edinburgh Festival, which got a little bit of critical acclaim. I think I was described as portly pontiff by Alan Brown. So it started a vague thing going in the back of my head that possibly there was something in this acting business, but I was determined to draw at that stage.
Now, you were talking about the beginnings of Private Eye. Now, this coalesced out of all these university magazines, did it?
It did, really, because they do, in the history of Private Eye, which has now been produced, in which I disappear on page 45, but have a tremendous first 45 pages, they do finally admit that I was the person who, when they all came down from university, I said, take a year before you all become chiropodists and actuaries and go into the city and all that sort of thing, all the father's business. Just take a year and carry on doing what you did at the universities. I said, why don't we start a magazine?
You were a sort of father figure in this.
In a strange sort of way, except I had no idea how we would do it. And very luckily, Peter Osborne was listening when I said this and said, this is very possible. And he found out how he could produce a magazine cheaply and worked out all we needed was £800 and we could start Private Eye. And luckily, sitting in another corner of the pub was another ex-Oxford called Andrew Osborne who said, I have £800, which is a fortune in those days. And that was how we just started it.
Yes.
It sort of crept out, which I think is quite a good way to start things.
What was the reaction to the first issue?
We tried three sort of dummies out on people, which was quite clever, on yellow paper, and all stapled together by various debutantes that Andrew Osborne knew, very saucy ladies and sort of Chanel dresses.
Very useful contact.
Very useful. Very hard-working. They were, and of course, able to stay up all hours with their stapling machines. And then they distributed them on things like London Bridge. They handed them out free if they couldn't get any money off people. And we did these three, and then about the start of 61, I think it was, we actually produced issue 4, which was the first one that went national. It was very well received.
Yeah.
There was nothing like it.
Now, were you actually on the staff? Have you ever been on the staff?
I was on the staff for I was officially sort of joint editor, and then we created an editorial board in which I was art editor and food. We used to name ourselves at the start. Then we stopped doing it after Randolph Churchill sued us because he picked out everybody, including the secretaries and the distributors and everybody, and sued the lot. So then we went anonymous.
I see.
But at one stage, I think I probably worked for about 4 or 5 years as a staff member, editor, art editor, come in, I think you wanted to be, with Christopher Booker and Richard Ingrams.
Well, let's change the subject. Let's have another record.
This takes me hurtling back down the years. It's actually the end of my school days, I think, we first got this record. And it's a very pleasant, relaxing one. It'll be good to lie on the beach and play this once a year. It's Louis Armstrong and Bing Crosby singing Gone Fishing.
I'll tell you why I can't find you. Every time I go out to your place, you gone fishing.
Ah, you know.
But there's a sign upon your door.
Uh-huh.
Gone fishing.
I'm real gone, man.
You ain't working anymore.
Could be.
There's your hole out in the sun where you left the row half done. You claim that hoeing ain't no fun.
But I can prove it.
You ain't got no ambition. Gone fishing. By a shady, weighty pool.
Shangri-La. Really La.
I'm wishing I could be that kind of fool.
Shall I twist your arm?
I'd say no more work for mine.
Welcome to the club.
On my door I'd hang a sign. Gone fishing. Instead of just a wishing.
Papa Bing, I stopped by your place a time or two lately, and you aren't home either.
Well, I'm a busy man, Louie. I got a lot of big deals cooking. I was probably tied up at the studio.
You aren't tied up, you dog. You're just playing old gone fishing.
Babble, 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 babble.
There's a sign upon your door.
Pops, don't blab it around, will you?
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got me a piece of Gary.
Cows need milking in the barn.
I have the twins on that. The tail each take a side.
But you just don't give a darn.
Give 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
You just never seem to learn.
Man, you taught me.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing.
Gone fishing. Buzzle, dazzle, dazzle, dazzle. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with you.
Gone fishing. Get
away from me, boys, you're bothering me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing instead of just a wishing.
Bubble, baby, bubble, bubble, bubble,
oh, yeah. yeah.
Bing Crosby and Louis Armstrong. Now, you were on the staff, if we may put it that way, a private eye. You also had these ambitions about acting.
They weren't really ambitions. If I was to tell you how my acting career started, I was standing in the King's Head and Eight Bells in Chelsea, proud I'd just started, and Richard Ingrams and another lovely soul who used to be a theatrical director and now has a second-hand bookshop in Leeds, had a, it was a bright idea. They had a theatre company of pros who used to go around schools doing the shows, or bits of shows, and talking to the kids about it afterwards. It was called Tomorrow's Audience. It was great to encourage children all over the country to actually enjoy theatre, because a lot of them never see it, and take it up in later life and go to the theatre. And they'd been given the Marlowe Theatre Canterbury for a fortnight and weren't absolutely certain what to do. They had a sort of show of their own in the first week. And the second week, they were given by Spike Milligan, who they approached, a play called The Bed Sitting Room. And Graham Stark was going in the lead of this and fell out. And so they had about a week to go, didn't know what to do. And suddenly I saw them talking about this and I realized they had a problem. They were looking at me strangely and they said, "You'd do it, won't you?" And I said, "Well," they said, "do this Bed Sitting Room in Marlowe Theatre Canterbury for a week." And I think they offered me something like £12, I think.
Was it?
£12. Well, as private, I was getting £8 a week. Suddenly, that was £20 a week. I thought, this is very good. And anyway, I'll be able to tell my grandchildren I've been on the stage for a week. I mean, that's very... So I went up and joined Equity, which required knocking on the door and saying, "I'd like to join Equity, please." And they'd give them the £9 or whatever it was. I was beginning to show a loss already. I think it was £9 then. And then off I went. And I did actually get a sparkling review from Kenneth Tynan, who came to see it. I think I was described as brilliant bespectacled, which was half right, and the half but was right, I went, anyway, I don't wear glasses. Yeah. And that led to a private eye review. A strange agent, who later became a pimp, came to me and said, anything I want to do of a review nature or anything like that, he would put up. And I said, well, private eye, we could certainly do something. And I was thinking of retirement anyway, but I thought, well, this is one last shot. It was a place, a room at the top of Ilford, which was about halfway up a furniture store. And it was like a fallout shelter, really. And we did this, John Wells, Richard Ingrams and I, and Barbara Windsor, which is a strange quartet, but it was meant to be a sort of answer to Beyond the Fringe.
But it was in that cabaret in Ilford that you were discovered.
That was it. I mean, when I do the Broadway musical of my life, that is the moment when the producer leaps up, which was Ned Sherrin, came in. And I was, for some strange quirk, doing a Harold Macmillan impersonation, and he was looking idly for a Harold Macmillan impersonator. It's the only impersonation I've ever done, except for Billy Eckstein, which I won't bore you with. Terrifying sound. I also do Edmund Hockridge, which is wasted on people. But Harold Macmillan was what he was looking for. And so I was offered the pilot of That Was the Week.
So you became a telefigure, but you threw it all up to fight an election. Was this political idealism?
This was a terrible error of judgment, actually. We were sitting in the pub saying, what a dreadful thing, Sir Alec Douglas Hume taking over. We must do something about it. He's going up to Kinross and West Perthshire to stand for Parliament so he can descend from the Lords and back among the minions again. And while we were thinking, what on earth can we do about it, somebody threw in that somebody ought to go up there and stand against him. Then I realised all eyes were upon me. And I said, well, all right, I'll do it, vaguely. And I thought, I'll talk about it when we get back to the office. And the drink has worn off. And the moment we got back to the office, phone went to the Evening Standard saying, we hear you're standing for Parliament against... And it was too late. I said, foolishly, said yes. It was quite funny to take satire into the field. It just happened to be the wrong field.
You could have lost your deposit.
Oh, the deposit went straight down the drain.
How many votes did you get?
45, and I think I can name all of them. Most of them, rather a cheery gang of dustmen who I got on very well with in Creef, I think it was.
William, let's have record number 5.
I think probably the best musical ever written. I think it was Guys and Dolls. I love it madly. And this was really a sort of keen contest between either The Overture Again, which has a lovely bit of, I got a horse right here, his name is Paul Revere, that, or a marvellous song, which is very rarely sung by anybody, which is More I Can't Wish You, which is a sweet number. It's father addressing daughter, and father is played here by a deeply breathing old gentleman who sings rather as I do, I think. I mean, I like people who sound as they've just got up when they're singing, called Pat Rooney Sr.
Mansions I can wish you, 7 footmen all in red, and calling cards upon a silver tray. But more I cannot wish you than to wish you find your love, your own true love this day. Standing there, gazing at you, full of the bloom of youth. Standing there, gazing at you with a sheep's eye and a licorice tooth. A music I can wish you, merry music while you're young, and wisdom when your hair is turned to gray. But more I cannot wish you than to wish you find your love, your own true love, this day. With a sheep's eye and a licorice tooth, and the strong arms to carry you away.
Pat Rooney Sr. in the song he sang in the Broadway production of Guys and Dolls. So, William, you gave up your political ambitions. You went back to television. You also did some films.
Yes, Nothing But the Best, I think, was the first one I did, which is a lovely film. It was Frederick Raphael's first film. It was directed by Clive Donner. It was all very smart. Alan Bates was in it. Millicent Martin was in it. And I had what I think they refer to as a distinguished cameo. I kept turning up at odd moments. Didn't actually appear a lot, but it was very pleasant, funny little scenes. I suppose the biggest one I did, and the most joyous in a way, was Those Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines, which I thought was the start of a tremendous movie career and transpired to be virtually the end of it. But because I was very cheap, they could keep me on. It took about 6 months to make. And I was in the happy position of being the one that they pushed the plot along with. When they actually got towards the end of the film, most of the great actors, the Gert Frobes and the rest of them, had all gone back to their various countries to do their bit. So I was the only one who could do anything. So I'd be constantly in little scenes where I'd leap into a tent and say, ah, here we are in Calais, or hello, Paris, or just plot moving. Yeah. So I worked on it for about 6 months, I think.
This precarious life of the stage and screen, had you responsibilities? Were you married by this time?
Not yet. No, I got married in 67, I think. I've got trouble with working out when I got married.
You have a wife and you have a son.
A wife and a son, and two distinguished stepsons who live in Australia.
And you began to write publications.
Yes, not very successfully at that stage, but I was getting into books. I suppose the first really successful book I did was Super Pig, which was about the end of the 70s, towards the end of the 70s.
And you became more or less king of the panel shows. You were on the air a great deal, sitting in a row with three or four other people.
I think basically because I'm sort of cheap again and unscripted. I work quite well without a script. So I'm good for programs. I don't want to expend a lot, but just fill the screens for half an hour. Mm-hmm. And my excuse for doing them is it buys you time to do all the other things.
The theatre, after Canterbury, it took a year or two, but you did make the West End.
Ultimately, 20 years later, I finally got to the West End in Pass the Butler.
Pass the Butler.
By Eric Idle.
You did the tour as well. It didn't do too well in Poole.
Poole? No, I blame the theatre, not the folk. The theatre was one of these modern ones where I think to cut back on cost, they'd actually done nothing about acoustics. And you would walk around the stage, one moment you fired a joke and it sort of whistled, ricocheted around the set and echoed throughout the theatre. If you moved a yard in another direction, it sort of fell like lead at your feet. I mean, it was terrifying. And then when they opened the doors just for the interval, anything on stage, sort of girls at the back would open the exit doors so they could make their way to the bars for the interval. Everything on stage began to blow away. There were a lot of newspapers in it, and it was where the newspapers flying past you. Of course, we had poor father up the back in this life support system, and he began to rattle and shake, and the bottles hanging would bang together. Terrifying theatre.
But you did all right in the West End.
West End, we did about 4 months. What did for us, I think, was the Falklands. After about 3 months, the Falklands started, and I think people stayed at home to discover how they were going rather than go and have a cheery night out at the theatre, which I think was probably the better thing to do.
It's time we had another record. What now?
Now I think something. I've been a bit laid back so far, but one of the ones I do hum quite frequently. And I actually once sang this to a room full of startled women at Girton College, Oxford, I think, at a cabaret night. I thought I can't be funny all the time. I'll be sexy for once. And I sang The Night Has a Thousand Eyes, which was originally sung by Bobby V, and Tim Rice speaks very highly of it, so it can't be all bad.
Put a thousand eyes. You say that you're at home when you phone me, and how much you really care. So you keep telling me that you're lonely. I'll know if someone is there. 'Cause a night has a thousand eyes, and a thousand eyes can't help but see if you are true to me. So remember when you tell those little white lies that a night has a thousand eyes.
The night has a thousand eyes. You've recently published your first novel.
Yes, it's taken a long time coming. The plot came from various areas, and I think basically it was after 22 years of doing fact. Oh, the shared joy of getting into fiction.
This
wonderful.
A comic novel. A knock 'em down and drag 'em out comic novel.
What I like about it most is they'll never be able to make a film of it. I think an awful lot of novels nowadays, you can tell from the locations that the writer is rather hoping not only to sell the film rights, but get to write the script and get to the locations he's written about.
It could be a cartoon film, because you've done some very funny drawings yourself.
They could animate it. That is true. I mean, it concerns basically Dr. W. Grayson, Dr. Watson, and Dr. Jekyll. And it's set in the 90s, and it's roughly, I describe it as a sequel to The War of the Worlds. I mean, H.G. Wells did end The War of the Worlds by saying there was no doubt that the Martians would come back. So it's a Victorian knockabout,
yes,
set in that period.
And what have you called it?
Just W.G. Grace's last case, which I think is quite enticing.
We haven't read about his first one yet.
That was, it was true. Do you remember Trent's last case, E.C. Bentley?
Of course.
That was his first book.
Let's have record number seven.
Record number seven, I've never really heard all the way through. It's 7 minutes long, but I've always liked the tune. I find it extravagantly catchy, and the words cheer me up enormously, and I think this could be very good for dancing on the beach by myself or with the... Perhaps I'm allowed a parrot or something of that nature. Anyway, it's Michael Naismith, who used to be one of the Monkees, and it's a song called Rio.
I'm hearing the light from the window. I'm seeing the sound of the sea. My feet have gone loose from their moorings. I'm feeling quite wonderfully free. And I think I will travel to Rio, using the music for flight. There's nothing I know of in Rio, but it's something to do with the night. It's notion to fly down to Rio tonight. I probably won't fly down to Rio, but then again, I just won't.
Michael Naismith, Rio. I'm sorry you can't have another 20 minutes of that. It's good stuff. Now, you're on this desert island. Have you any manual skills that would help you? Could you build a hut?
I'm all right at black and deckering and light bulbs and electric switches, but I'd be absolutely useless on a desert island. Uh-huh. Hopeless. I once caught a fish. I never felt so awful in my life, and I finally let it go. And
could you catch another one if you were hungry?
I think I'd have to go vegetarian. It may not be a bad thing.
Would you try to escape? Could you build a craft? Could you build a raft?
No. No, that'd be far beyond me. Anyway, my navigation would be so hopeless. And I'd certainly have no idea where I was. And anyway, I might be beginning to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
I think a little bit of solitude. I am working on this enormous Mount Rushmore-like cliff face. I'm doing the cliff face. I've already done Clement Attlee. And I'm working through the great prime ministers of my time.
Where are you doing this?
On this cliff face to the left.
I see, yes. Well, that'll be rather nice.
That'll occupy the time.
Of course it will. Yes, there are a lot of prime ministers to get through.
Oh, heavens, yes. I'm going to have a lot of trouble with Callan in Rock, I think.
Yes.
Chin.
You can do heads of the opposition and leaders of the opposition.
Oh, it's endless. Mm-hmm. Until the island runs out, I could turn it into one great sculpture.
Last record.
Last record is the first song I could ever sing in my life. Now, you may think this is going to be something silly like Mary, Mary, quite contrary. I mean, in actual fact, it's Ambrose. My musical education started in about 1939, I suppose, when Hitler decided to try and kill me for reasons I could never understand at that age. And all I was left with to listen to on a wind-up gramophone were my mother's old dance band records of the 30s. So at the age of three, I could actually sing my way through Ambrose playing "I Guess I'll Have to Change My Plan." Every bit of it, even the intro.
Realize that be another man. I overlooked that point completely until the big affair began. Before I knew where I was at, I found myself upon the shelf, and that was that. I tried to reach the moon, but when I got there, all that I could get was the air. My feet are back upon the ground. I've lost the one girl I found.
Ambrose and his orchestra, "I Guess I'll Have to Change My Plan," and the man that you used to imitate was Sam Brown.
Was it? I didn't know that.
If you could take only one disc out of the eight you've chosen, which would it be?
That would be it.
Right. Ambrose and his orchestra. And you're entitled to take one luxury, any one object that would give you great pleasure to have, but which is of no practical use whatever.
This doesn't count the many chisels, which I've obviously had to do these rock faces.
No,
well,
no chisels. Have to make your own chisels.
In which case, as I am totally unmusical, I think the thing I would like, given a lifetime's ambition to be a Hoagy Carmichael figure in some low bar somewhere on a Pacific island, I think crooning gently at a piano, I would actually try and learn the piano. I think this is a perfect opportunity. There's nobody there to listen, except for the parrot.
Yes,
I would teach myself the piano.
And one book, you already have the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare.
It's hard. It would be very tempting to say wisdom, because it's a good occupation I've found over many years sitting in the bath to actually follow the career of some unsuccessful cricketer in the 1920s and see just how awfully well. I mean, that's quite good. But I think I'd be such a more education. I've never read enough of G.K. Chesterton, and I love him madly. And if my voice was slightly higher, I could actually do a one-man show, but then everybody thinks he's got a deep voice because he looks like one. He looks like a basso profundo, but in fact he's that really properly. But I could work on a one-man show of Chestertoniana, and I think that would be... He's very funny and very good and infinitely wise and would perk me up.
So, an anthology of the Father Brown books?
No, all his other books, I think. I must have gone to Father Brown, tell the truth, but everything else he wrote, The Pony of Notting Hill, the lovely books he wrote. Mm. Very funny man.
As much as we can cram between two covers.
Yes.
And thank you, William Rushton, for letting us hear your Desert Island Disc.
A pleasure.
Goodbye, everyone.